separate religions from the state, it'll be good for human freedom. Arguments about fairness or justice. So arguments that say that if you separate religious institutions from state institutions, the state will be a better guarantor of equal treatment for citizens and others who find themselves in the state's borders.
Now, my kind of position today has really been one of consistency. If we're going to advance the idea of equality, and we're going to advance the idea that people should be treated equally and so on, should have certain rights, and that the state should represent them, there is no argument you could argue to say that the state should separate itself from religion.
You separate religion and state, you lose out on much that religious groups have to offer the common good, and you leave them feeling that the state doesn't really represent or even recognise their deepest commitments.
The best frame for freedom, and also for freedom of religion, is a secular country. In France, for instance, you have a lot of religious people.
My belief is that separation is the best way to guarantee freedom of thought, conscience and religion, and equal treatment of different religious and non-religious people within a society.
Now I live in a secular country, in France, and actually I find no better frame for the freedom of religion than a secular country.
No state is really neutral. I mean, the French kind of banned the niqab and the hijab and so on, with discussions particularly about Muslims.
When you live in a theocracy, I grew up in a Muslim theocracy in Morocco, your daily life is completely ruled by, let's say, rules that have been written 15 centuries ago.
I come from a religious tradition that's had 1,300 years of religious tolerance. I would even say more than you could see in the West, because under Islamic systems, each religion or religious community had autonomous courts, fully blown courts, which I think even the West hasn't been able to achieve with its minorities.
Never been involved in debate that doesn't in some way come down to semantic questions of what words actually mean. I think this is an unavoidable problem.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Chatham House tonight, and welcome to the speakers for this evening, who I will introduce in a moment. I've got a set of strict and precise directions here, so a few brief pieces of housekeeping which will hopefully keep us in order. The first will not be a surprise to you. We are on the record tonight. We can also comment on tonight's event via Twitter. Please feel free to do that. There's a hashtag. It's facing us on this screen. I think you've got screens to the left and right that you can see. It's CH events. And if you do have your phones out, can you check that they're on silent mode? Tweeting, yes. Telephone calls, no. So, yes, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's debate. The motion being, should religion and the state be separate? This is an area of debate that for some time was considered somewhat closed, at least for certain areas of the world and so on, and has returned to the forefront of the agenda, as I'm sure I don't need to explain. I'm going to introduce the speakers who will be arguing that yes, that religion and the state should be separate. So I have Andrew Copson on my right, who is Chief Executive of Humanist UK, the British Humanist Association as was, and President of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. He has written much work in this area, and his book we can see displayed to my left there, and it's available for you to peruse after the event today, and probably buy as well, I imagine. Joining Andrew is Zineb Al-Razoui, who is a Moroccan-born French human rights activist and a columnist on the satirical weekly magazine Charlie Hebdo between 2011 and 2016, is that right? She's published widely in this area and also co-founded the pro-democracy, pro-secularism movement Mali before joining Charlie Hebdo in 2011. Arguing against the motion tonight is Nick Spencer, who's director of research at Theos. Nick has also written widely in the area, and his most recent books include The Evolution of the West and Atheists, The Origin of the Species. Nick is also a visiting research fellow at the Faith and Civil Society Unit at Goldsmiths, University of London. And then last but by no means least, arguing against the motion tonight as well, we have Abdullah Al-Andalusi, an international speaker and thinker, an activist from Islam and Muslim Affairs. He's also co-founder of the Muslim Debates Initiative, founded in 2009, and that's a forum that promotes open dialogue and critical debate between thinkers, academics, politicians and public speakers of all backgrounds. Abdullah also speaks widely in diverse forums, community centres, universities and across international media. So I'm very pleased to welcome this esteemed panel to discuss the motion tonight. I should say that I am Lois Lee. I am a research fellow at the University of Kent in religious studies, and I am evidently your chair for tonight. So I'm going to, as you might have heard, as you arrived, we've got a strict set of timings that we're going to keep to. I'm channeling my Dimbleby. I'm going to keep control of the debate. But I think there's a lot to discuss and a lot of nuance to bring in. And then we're going to leave good time for questions from the floor so we can have a good discussion following the initial remarks. Before we move to that, you should all have a pad that looks like a small calculator on the seat that you're sat on. It might be in your hand. Can you put your hand up if you don't have a keypad? Okay, so far so good. So what we're going to do is use these to respond, have the audience respond to the motion today, and we'll have there'll be a second chance to vote on the motion towards the end of the evening to see if in light of the discussion we're taken anywhere new. So this is the motion for this evening. Should religion and the state be separate? You can vote now if you can. One, yes. Two, no. Three, not sure. I know we're working against the clock, so we've got about 10 more seconds to vote. It does look like about 9 of the machines are working.
Ooh, oh, maybe 10.
Oh, maybe they're waking up. Maybe you have to press very hard. Okay, so we managed a 10, so we had a yes, an overwhelming majority there for the idea that religion and the state should be separate. Okay, this is a good fun innovation. I think it needs some foolproofing. We're going to turn to the quite serious matter now of the motion at hand, and I'm going to invite, in the first instance, all of the speakers to set out their stall. They've got 7 minutes to do that. And I'm going to invite Andrew to begin.
Thank you very much. So all of the states that have sought to separate religious institutions, either churches or other sorts of religious establishment from themselves, have done so in the last couple of hundred years for lots of different reasons. Of course, for very culturally specific reasons, depending on the historical moment at which they did so, and also their own cultural context and the individual country. But boiling it down, if you look to see if there are any particular arguments that are shared by almost all secularist initiatives to separate religion and state, I think they fall into broadly four categories. Arguments about freedom, so the argument being that if you separate religions from the state, it'll be good for human freedom. Arguments about fairness or justice, so arguments that say that if you separate religious institutions from state institutions, the state will be a better guarantor of equal treatment for citizens and others who find themselves in the state's borders. Arguments about peace, people who say that this separation is a better way to guarantee social peace, avoid civil conflict of various types, and arguments about democracy. People who claim that we can only really have equal citizenship in a state where there is no one religion identified as being the national religion, and hence implicitly devaluing the equal citizenship of people who don't belong to that religion. So I want to take those four types of argument in turn. The argument about individual freedom, this is based on a very particular view of human dignity. It starts from the assumption that, as far as possible, we all want to be free to make up our own minds about important questions. This includes questions around religion and belief, and that imposing opinions on individuals by state sanction is a violation of this freedom. Now, this view of human dignity is obviously very strongly associated with a particular liberal humanist idea of what the individual is. If you think John Stuart Mill, you won't be going far wrong. This idea that the human being, as Mill said, is not a machine, but a tree that needs freedom to develop on all sides, and that the individual needs to be free to make choices, to find their own path, to find their own way, and that restriction on that, constraint applied to that freedom, puts a cap on human development, development of the individual, and also of social, on social development. And that as a result of this, we need freedom of conscience, freedom of thought, freedom of religion, and these freedoms have a corresponding high value in the political view of any liberal. But it's not just liberal humanist grounds on which these arguments are made. The first people to make them in Europe were the Baptists, very famously, in England and in the Netherlands, when they said, Thomas Helwys said, men's religion to God is between God and themselves, the king shall not answer for it, and neither may the king be judge between God and man. So it's also possible on theistic grounds to make the argument for freedom. Muslims who want to support it point to the passage in the Quran that says there should be no compulsion in religion, and other religious traditions have their own version of this idea that faith and belief, if it is to be true, if it is to be pure, if it is to be genuine, then it should be unrestricted, unguided, uncoerced. And that's a very common view amongst large numbers of religious people, as well as liberal humanists. So this argument for freedom, this idea that if the state is selecting and promoting through its institutions, its schools, its approach to public policy, and the messages that it sends you as a citizen, one particular religion or belief, it's a restriction of your freedom, and that is bad because your freedom is an important part of what makes you human and allows you to realise your potential. So the argument for freedom is an important argument. The argument for fairness, or the argument around justice, characterises lots of arguments in favour of the separation of religion and the state. It starts with the idea that every individual in society should, as far as possible, be treated equally, regardless of their religious or philosophical convictions, and should not be disadvantaged or privileged because of them. And it's pretty clear to see, really, why this is. If I'm a Muslim in a state that restricts university education to Buddhists, or a Jew in a state that restricts high political office to atheists, or an atheist in a state that restricts religious instruction in its schools to Islam or to Christianity, I'm plainly being treated less fairly, less justly than my fellow citizens of other religions or beliefs. And again, this idea is quite strongly associated with liberal humanist political ideas. Obviously, there's social contract thought in it. If you think of John Rawls and his Veil of Ignorance, it provides you with a nice device for understanding this argument. So John Rawls, in his book Theory of Justice, says you have to imagine that you're behind a veil of ignorance. Behind this veil, you don't know what your place in society is going to be, your class position, your social status, or even your beliefs. What sort of state would you like to live in? Would you like to live in a state that advantages Christians, or advantages Jews, or advantages Muslims, or advantages humanists? No, you wouldn't. You'd like to live in a state that treated all those people equally, because you don't know what you will be, you don't know whether you'll be advantaged or disadvantaged. And this device is an attempt to point out what a fair political settlement might be, and fairness in the sense of religion in the state is best embodied in a secular state. The veil of ignorance has the advantage in relation to secularism of being true, because you really don't know what you might be tomorrow or next week. People change their minds about religion and belief. The argument from peace, 1 minute. The argument from peace is very simple. It's a pragmatic argument. It says, look what happens when the state does choose a side, when it does involve itself in questions of religion or belief. Look at the blood-drenched fields of Europe and of Asia to see what results. And we don't want that sort of strife. We want the state to lift itself above those sorts of divisions. And the argument from democracy, again, is very simple, possibly best made by Indian secularists, both in the past and today, saying, you know, when you have a society of considerable diversity, if the state picks a religion, I'm doing a job for you. Okay. If the state picks a religion, then obviously people won't feel the sense of equality that is necessary for participation in a democratic society. So in short, those four arguments constitute, I think, a more or less comprehensive case for the separation of church and state, or religion and state.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. Good to pass to Nick.
Thank you very much, Lewis. Good evening, everybody. The first thing I'd like to do is to clarify exactly what we're debating tonight. The question before us is not whether the church and state should be separate, or whether Sharia law should be recognised by the state, or even whether we should have bishops in the House of Lords. They're all valid debates. They're all questions on which people will legitimately hold different views. They're not, however, the debate question before us tonight. That question is whether religion and the state should be separate, and it's an important distinction. Because if you think carefully about what religion is and what the state does and what the separation of two would do to a liberal society, you begin to see the challenges. Firstly, religion. The classic mistake we all make when thinking about religion is to confuse it with religious structures. In reality, religion is what is done and said and thought by religious people, and sometimes even by non-religious people. It's beliefs, practices, rituals, ethical commitments, ways of life. Religion is how people, an awful lot of people, understand and navigate the world. Enforcing a state that is at best indifferent to those commitments and ways of life, and at worst actively antipathetic to them, is problematic. To be clear, no one here tonight is advocating privilege, let alone theocracy. Neither religious nor non-religious groups are owed any blank checks by the state. To be even clearer, it is quite possible to be in favour of the disestablishment of the church and still to recognise that the state itself cannot separate itself entirely from religion. To a priori separate religious people and their beliefs and commitments from the processes and objectives of the state is to take in itself a worryingly illiberal turn. Now, I know the response to this. It goes something like, separating religion and state does not mean excluding religious people from the processes of the state. For example, it doesn't mean they can't vote or campaign. It simply means that religious beliefs and groups are separate from the state itself, and religious citizens can participate but not appeal to their religious beliefs when pursuing certain policies. However, the game changer here, I think, is what kind of state we have and enjoy in the Western world. Put it this way, separation of religion and state might be conceivable if we had a night watchman state, which simply concerned itself with defence, criminal justice and the policing of contracts. But we do not have a night watchman state. On the contrary, we have a state that is actively involved in virtually every aspect of our lives. Housing, teaching, healing, employment, marriage, parenting, transport, agriculture, you name it, the state is somehow involved. For that Leviathan to be deliberately and self-consciously a religion-free zone is deeply problematic if it is deaf to those beliefs and languages and commitments that religious people hold. Are we really saying that the state should refuse to recognise the conscience of a Catholic nurse, or the pacifist Quaker who is a conscientious objector, or the Muslim state school teacher who wants to wear a hijab, or the Sikh police officer who wants to wear a turban? To say that the state must not formally recognise those religious commitments, whether it's dress or holidays or ethical frameworks, is to treat those citizens to whom those things are important as somehow second class. More positively, do we really want a situation in which the state refuses to work with religious groups in their desire to educate or heal or house or rehabilitate people in the community simply because it insists it cannot get involved with them because it is separate from them? Public money on which the state depends is the public's money. To deny the religious people recognition and respect is to betray the best hopes of a liberal society. The religious should not be granted privilege, but they should have suitable recognition and reasonable accommodation from the state, just as the state should recognise and accommodate those who have no religious beliefs in their particular interests and commitments. Perhaps worse than this, though, to separate religion and the state in that de jure way is to provoke a response. To see this, you don't have to go to the ghastly reality of Soviet Russia, which began by passing its impeccably sounding decree on the freedom of conscience and on state and religious association. We can talk about the separation of religion and state in France, or secularisation of Turkey in the 20th century, or India, or even the US, which is seemingly the world's most successful example of the separation of religion and state. Time and again, recent history has shown that when religion is formally excluded from the mechanisms and objectives of the state, in which all citizens are fully participating members, religious citizens tend to feel underrepresented and disadvantaged, and most worryingly, they have started behaving antagonistically. We've seen this in recent decades with what's happened in Turkey, with Hindu nationalism in India, with a growing number of disaffected Muslims in France, and with the emergence of the religious right in the US. To cite all those examples is emphatically not to side with them. It is rather to point out that if you separate religion and state, you lose out on much that religious groups have to offer the common good, and you leave them feeling that the state doesn't really represent or even recognise their deepest commitments. Rowan Williams said in a lecture to the NCVO a few years ago, isolating religious groups and refusing to harness the motivation they can bring is a recipe for resentment and rivalry and ultimately runs a higher risk of fostering extreme positions. We should, in conclusion, I think, be aiming not for separation, but for fairness. And on that note, it's worth noting that the countries that top the Economist Intelligence Unit's biannual democracy index do not have, as a rule, separation of religion and state. The democracy index is based on a number of measures pertaining to electoral processes and pluralism, civil liberties, the functioning of government, political participation and political culture. And those countries that top the democracy index are not marked by separation of religion and state. They tend to have some, often minor, forms of entanglement. You can, in other words, have fairness and democratic accountability and participation without entire separation. It's quite possible to have a fair and just polity without going all the way to the length of what is practically difficult, ethically dubious and politically illiberal by deliberately and consciously severing ties, all ties between religion and state. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you, Nick. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Zineb without further ado.
Okay, could you please do the chronometer for me?
Of course.
For you? Yeah, so I don't answer any point now from what.
No, this so is if you just set your okay. Door and we'll give you a chance to respond in a moment.
Okay, I grew up in a theocracy. So I'm going to talk about experience, the experience I had in a theocracy. Now I live in a secular country in France, and actually I find no better frame for the freedom of religion than a secular country. When you live in a theocracy, I grew up in a Muslim theocracy in Morocco, your daily life is completely ruled by, let's say, rules that have been written 15 centuries ago in a Bedouin context. It's as simple as, for instance, as a Moroccan woman, I can't marry the man of my choice. I only can marry a Muslim man. So if he is British, French, I don't know, non-believer, whatever, he must convert by the law of the state. When my father or my mother die, I can't inherit as my brothers. I only inherit half of what they inherit, while I tax the same and I pay my coffee the same price. You cannot just go and have a beer with your colleague after you work, because it's forbidden. You're supposed to be a Muslim. Beers are not for you. They are for tourists. Sex without being married leads you directly to jail, especially if you are a woman. I've been arrested for prostitution, that's how they call it, because I was with a man in my apartment. The casinos in many Muslim countries, they exist, but they are for tourists. In Egypt, for instance, casinos are forbidden for the Egyptian, even for the Coptic Egyptian. And the reason is that money games are forbidden in Islam. I have been arrested in 2009 in Morocco because I was trying to eat a sandwich during Ramadan, because there is a law in the civil code, Article 222, saying that if you eat or drink water, not even alcohol, publicly during Ramadan, so you deserve jail. If you are a Muslim-born, and you decide to believe in something else, you decide to become a freethinker, non-believer, if you say it publicly, sentenced to death. These laws are still applied in Saudi Arabia and Mauritania. You also have a lot of Muslim-born people who decided to believe in Jesus and to convert to Christianism. They live in clandestinity, they baptize in their bathtubs, and they gather secretly in their homes because they can have no access to the churches, because the churches are for foreigners, not for the Moroccans, not for the Algerians. So this is the life in a theocracy. Any single simple freedom you have, you guys here in Britain, are denied in a theocracy. We can also add that if someone among you knows a theocracy that is a democracy, he can show me where is this country, because no theocracy is a democracy. There is no theocracy respecting human rights, freedom. Let me talk also about equality between men and women. What if we apply religions blindly? What shall we do for women? Because in religions, women are not equal to men. And that's the case in Islam. And when you are a Muslim woman, you are denied many rights men enjoy. So that's why I think that, as Andrew said, the best frame for freedom, and also for freedom of religion, is a secular country. In France, for instance, you have a lot of religious people. Some, let's say, Muslim people, their own, their personal belief is to marry someone from their religion. They have the right to marry someone who is Muslim in France. They marry in the city hall, and after that they go to the mosque and marry a Muslim person. But in Morocco, you don't have that choice. You only can marry the people who are authorized by the state. You cannot even change your religion. As a Muslim born, if I go back to my country, and I still go back to my country, I'm married to a French man. I didn't want him to convert, so my marriage is not recognized in Morocco. So my child is a bastard in the Moroccan law. So my child doesn't inherit if I have anything, if I buy, let's say, a house or something like that in Morocco. This is the reality. These are the simple examples of what is a society ruled by religion. It is not something about theory, it is not something that we can dream of, it is something that really exists in many parts of the world, and it is a continuous, a daily violation of very simple and basic daily human freedoms and rights. This is what is to live under a theocracy. So, in a genuine democracy, the only mechanism of representation I know is the vote. And Of course religious people can exist. Of course people have the right to believe what they want. They have the right to have a spirituality. But they don't have the right to impose that spirituality to the others. They don't have the right to ask for a specific exception for the general law according to their own belief. Otherwise, the society will not be a space we share, where we share universal rights and duties, but it will become a place where many ghettos exist without really communicating with each other. For me, real anti-racism, real universalism, is the fact of having the same rights, same duties, and saying that the values, the universal values of freedom, equality between people, and equality between men and women, freedom of belief, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, are values that everyone deserves.
Well, thank you, and thank you everyone for coming. I think we want to clarify, the title of this debate is not about any particular religion or state system. The debate is purely whether a state should have some connection or relationship with religion, other than simply ignoring it, which is what complete separation between the two would require. Now, it must be clearly understood that no one here will be arguing that anyone deserves more financial or social advantage over others because of their religion or none. And also, to point out, this is not the first time in history that we have multi-faith societies. A number of the systems in the past guaranteed a degree of plurality and rights to exercise religion. From the Islamic Ottoman Millet system, where each religious group had autonomy and their own legal systems, to the Westphalian system in Europe, from which the modern West emerged, where one Christian denomination was established by the state, but tolerated others to exist and worship within their realm as they pleased. The recognition of religion by the state is about protecting conscience and fairness, because most people don't choose religion like they choose the color of their cars or the brand of their clothes. Religion is about what one believes and is convinced of, and in the performance of actions and rituals one believes is required by such conviction. So religion, or conviction in its broadest sense, is a worldview, whether spiritual or materialist, which is believed by its adherents to be true and an accurate description of their reality, which cannot easily be changed by one individual's own whim, nor by government diktat. And religion's scope is so broad that it defines a person's character more than the superficialities of their ethnicity or skin colour, to the extent that it shapes their interests and needs. Now, the state is formed by people who pay taxes and have needs. Therefore, the state's purpose should be to represent all their needs. And you can't fit all human beings into one box. Therefore, it's only natural for us to expect the state to recognize diversity, and that religion and ethical systems of its people are a matter of public interest, and to establish a relationship with it, whether it is regulation or special accommodations and protections against indirect discrimination and disadvantage. This is why religion and the state should not be separate, and this is why almost all countries, whether in the West or everywhere else, with the possible exception of North Korea, continue to choose some form of relationship between state and religion. Let's take the example of the United States of America and the two clauses of the US Constitution's First Amendment. Now, these are usually held up by some secularists as a model of state separation from religion. But the US Constitution's relationship with religion is not that black and white. Michael McConnell, a constitutional law scholar and former US Circuit Judge of the Court of Appeals, explains, "If there is a constitutional requirement for accommodation of religious conduct, it will most likely be found in the Free Exercise Clause, the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. And one example of the use of free exercise clause in the United States of America is the 1963 Sherbert versus Verner case, where a man used the clause to win his case after he was fired from his job for refusing to work on the Saturdays because he believed in the Sabbath. Another case in 1990 ruled in favor of a religious exemption for the illegal drug peyote used by a Native American, and it was then followed by a religious exemption clause stated into state law. So state law had an exemption from the uniform law or the universal law for religious reasons. In other words, instead of establishing a particular religion, the US Constitution grants a special form of protection to conscience and, in essence, all religion and none. In the UK and Europe, we see the state recognising the need of religious taxpayers, providing for state-funded faith schools, or like in Switzerland, state funding of the teaching of religion-specific classes for students of those beliefs. Additionally, the reality of human nature and politics is such that separation of religion from state is practically impossible without extreme draconian measures. Even if the state ignored religion and only recognized individuals and their demands, it would be susceptible to populist nationalism based upon religion redefined as a secular national culture, like the Hindutva in India, the Front National in France, or powerful lobby groups united by religious concerns repackaged as secular demands like the powerful conservative lobby in the United States of America. Even in states considered closer than the UK to full separation, like France, we see state funds still go to a large number of Catholic schools, and in the USA, to religious parochial schools via the student voucher system. Lastly, were we to fully separate state from religious-based concerns of its people, it would unbalance political platforms against controlling state power and against powerful unelected political lobbies in capitalist political systems known as corporate interests. With full separation, prophets would speak even louder than, prophets. To vote no to full separation is not to endorse the extreme of making a state coerce everyone to adopt one particular religion, but it's to actually to reject the other extreme, where the state completely separates itself from religion, whether ignoring it or worse, eradicating any public manifestation of religion in the paranoid attempt to free individuals from it, as Rousseau put it, to compel people to be free. One only needs to look at the French Revolution for that, for one example. A society would be fairer and more representative when the state isn't afraid to recognize public holidays such as Christmas or give tax breaks to religious charities, which my colleague Andrew Copson's Humanists UK also enjoys and receives equal right to in the UK. The state supports religious schools, allowing you to swear on your holy book in court or when taking public office. These are some of the things that many secularists want to remove in the name of separation of religion from state. To conclude, I argue that a state that equally recognizes people's religion and none is safer for all than a state that ignores it and who might consider it an annoyance or even potentially dangerous. Then I ask you to please vote no to full separation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you all. I think that set out some of the key issues very clearly. I'm going to, as promised, give you a chance to respond, but very briefly, so I want you to pick out something you particularly want to respond to. I get a sense that possibly you might want to tailor your remarks to thinking about the word separation in our motion today. I have a sense that there are some different ideas around, is separation religion free? Is this the argument, so we've had it put from Nick, that's an ideal that maybe you have in mind? Is that a correct representation of what you're arguing for? And I think on this side, I get a very clear impression that what you're arguing for is not theocracy. And so in some way, you appear to be secularists of sorts. You want to draw the line somewhere, but maybe slightly differently. So I think that sense of what this separation entails, might be helpful to clarify, but equally I open it to respond to anything you want to immediately. So I'll do it in the same order. So Andrew.
I think that's a very acute point. I mean, obviously we've been addressing a different question on both sides of this discussion so far, and of course words mean what you define them as wanting them to mean. So I mean that's to some extent inarguable. We can't really argue against it. For my part, I would say that certainly I don't think that to have a state separate from religion means that the state rejects all involvement or collaboration with religion. In fact, I would think it rather implies that it doesn't, because unless the state and religion are separate, how could one collaborate with the other? If they're not separate, they're identical. The secular state in India in particular has had a very dynamic relationship with religious organisations of various types in the pursuit of social justice ends and other political and social ends. So I think the idea that this wording of this motion, should religion and state be separate, would somehow imply that if you agreed with this proposition, you were saying the state should reject and hold at a distance and totally disregard religion, is perverse. And to use the specific example that Abdullah used, the First Amendment, which permits free exercise, is the clause that Jefferson was talking about when he coined the phrase separation of church and state. So to say that the First Amendment is somehow the opposite of separation of church and state when it's been seen as constitutive of it is completely wrong. So I would say that when religion and state are separate, of course the state will continue to take an interest in religion and religious people and their views, and religious people will hopefully continue to take an interest in the state and participate as citizens and as public service providers and so on and so forth, but the two will not be identical, and the state will have the objective, instead of endorsing a particular religion or religions, of seeking instead to maximise free exercise of religion and belief for all and equal treatment of all. And for me, that is the sort of separation that I would endorse. And that's not eccentric. I think that is what this phrase would commonly be taken to mean.
So the issue, as you rightly point out, Lewis, is what does separation mean? And the challenge, of course, it's a single word, and therefore you're trying to interpret it in a kind of monolithic way, whereas in actual fact we're talking about a spectrum here. At one end, where the two are thoroughly entangled and you live some kind of theocracy and they come in various different flavours, right at the other end where there is absolutely no involvement of the state grants no exceptions, it grants no public money to religious groups, or it refuses to get involved in any way, shape or form. Now, as Lewis correctly pointed out, no one here is advocating theocracy tonight, mercifully. The question is what level of separation there is. And I think the danger is that we fetishise that word when actually what we're looking for is fairness. Now, my view of fairness means that the state cannot but be entangled with religious commitments, because it needs to represent and recognise the commitments and beliefs and worldviews and patterns of life that is precious to a large number of its citizens. That will mean actively getting involved. That will mean actively granting exemptions to people who have conscience clauses for various issues, religious and non-religious. It will mean allowing public money to go to schooling, for example, or charitable activities that are ostensibly badged with that religion, rather than requiring that particular religion to take its commitments off. So it's actively partnering with religious groups and deploying public money for religious groups in order for them to serve the public good. It's actively allowing exemptions to people who believe that they have certain commitments that impose those certain conscientious points on them. Now, that to my mind isn't separation, that's actually involvement. It would be a shame if the whole thing came down to a semantic issue, but my sense of separation is the two not getting involved with one another, whereas what I'm advocating is for a state to be truly representative and respectful of the full range of its citizens' views. It needs to actively get involved through legislation and through the deployment of public money.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, religion is a social fact, so recognising religions, why not? But if the rules of these religions are in contradiction with the values and the laws of a state? This is the main question, because most of the religions have not done yet the work of adapting their texts and their rules to the modern laws and to human rights. So what can the state do when you have, for instance, in certain African countries, the Catholic Church forbidding, which is very influent in certain African countries, forbidding, banning the condoms in countries where people die from AIDS. What can the state do, for instance, when some Muslim communities in the West want to deprive their girls from certain rights, etc.? In these cases, the state has to intervene. The state does not only have the duty to guarantee the freedom of practicing a religion, but also the duty to limit the influence of the religious and the fact that the religious always are always seeking to have specific laws for them. And I want to give an example in France. In France, for instance, people used to say we have 6 million Muslims. Do they count me among the 6 million Muslims? That's an example. If we agree to let the religious rule their own communities, for instance, so where is the self, the self-arbitre, we call that in France? I don't define myself as a Muslim, even if I can be seen like that. I prefer to be a French citizen. I prefer not to live in a society where I will be identified as a member of a religious group and so submitted to the laws of that group. So for me, the main question is when the rules of the religion are in contradiction with the laws of the state.
I think my colleague Zainab actually, in a way, agrees with this side, but from a different angle. She believes that the state should interfere with religion, and therefore that goes against the idea of separation of state and religion. So she agrees with us, but from a different angle, we probably wouldn't agree with the French model, perhaps. If you have a state that endorses one religion, we'd all say that that's not the separation of religion from state. I think we can all agree on that. If it endorses one religion, it's not separation. But if a state endorses many religions, that would also be, again, not a separation. It just happens to be that there's more than one. In the UK, in Switzerland, in many countries around Europe, most countries around Europe, in fact, the state funds faith schools, or religious classes. The state funds the endorsement of religion. Charities get tax exemption, they get support from the state by charity states for the advancement of religion or the advancement of secular humanism, which my colleague Andrew, his organization benefits from, and equally so, all right, that's fine. So this is not the separation of religion from state, because the state's endorsing multiple religions. It just happens to be that it's not one anymore, it's just multiple. And the state wants to be fair in its equal treatment with its relationship with religion. And of course, we know we use the word relationship all the time. I mean, you have a couple, they are separated. It doesn't mean that before they were separated, they were literally one human being. You can have a relationship, you can get involved. And that's really what we're arguing. So no one, and this is the argument here, is really for us not to go to the extreme of when we call for the separation of religion from state. This demands the extreme of the complete detachment of state from religion, no endorsement, no relationship at all, complete ignoring of it, or worse, viewing it as a dangerous annoyance. And I think I'll just finish up that in a way this debate is not actually even really about secularism per se. Now many secularists take issue with tax exemptions for charities. They take issues with state-funded faith schools. They don't like these things. They view these things as against the principles of separation of religion from state. As for the American understanding of the separation, I think maybe Jefferson was referring to the first clause of that amendment, which is that the state should not make any establishment of any religion, but the free exercise thereof. The state is not allowed to interfere with the free exercise thereof. And so if a state makes a law that indirectly discriminates against one particular religion, they should make an exemption, which some secularists call that as religious privilege, But others call it as not fitting all human beings through one whole. Humans are different, they have diversity, you have to expect that. And I think I'll finish off with just dealing with Andrew Cobson's Veil of Ignorance argument. Well, it's not his copy, it's my argument. It's John Rawls. So John Rawls' argument is that before, if we were in this pre-incarnate state and we didn't know what religion we were going to be or what belief we were going to be, wouldn't we create a society, we'd all agree beforehand to create a society that didn't give any particular religion any privilege? And yes, of course. But that's not the only thing that those people would agree in their pre-incarnate state. They'd also agree that because they don't know the ultimate truth, what religion is right or wrong, what position is right or wrong, that the state which represents them will give endorsement and support to all religions. That is also something that they would not also disagree with. Why wouldn't they disagree with that? They don't know no privilege to any particular religion, but surely if we're going to create a state in our when we incarnate into this reality which caters to our needs, surely this state should recognize all our religious choices and support us in this, because surely the ethics and moral health of the nation is in the public interest. Thank you.
Right, I'm going to open to the floor. I can see hands going up immediately. There is a roving mic, and so there's lots of hands on this side. Okay, so there's a gentleman on the far right-hand side. There's a mic heading towards you, if you could speak directly into it. And please, can you say your name and your affiliation, and not just your affiliation with Chatham House?
Andrew Manel. I'm a PhD student at King's College London in the Religious Studies Department. I wanted to speak to the no question about a couple of things that I keep hearing. Religion and state, according to Spencer, argues that religious citizens feel disadvantaged. And you mentioned the emergence of the religious right as a problematic point, because how much worse would it be, my question would be, if they gained power? I'm a bit curious as to how you're framing this point, because it all seems rather good if you're talking about the emergence of the religious right as a 21st century Anglican looking into the emergence of this sort of, we see this as a radical thing, therefore isn't it good that we don't have such a separation in this country? If you're John Bunyan in Bedford Jail in 17th century England writing The Pilgrim's Progress, what I'm saying is probably looks very different. Militancy changes generationally, and the only preservation we have against that militancy in religion is a separation. And I've actually never heard anyone argue religion and church and state separate in a way that I'm hearing tonight. It almost seems like you're throwing a whole new framework for this question, very radically different than the common academic understanding, to sort of throw this question up and beat it down in a way that I've actually never heard before academically. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Do you want to respond to that?
It was directed to me, but do you want to take a few questions?
We'll see how we have time. We'll take this one and then we might take a few together.
Okay, so very briefly, counterfactuals are always very difficult. I think the religious right emerged in the 1970s and 80s playing on a narrative of disenfranchisement. And that was what gave them their power. It is interesting that they tended to lose that power and lose that influence in the 1980s and then again in the 2000s when they felt that they were in power. I don't think it's neither or. I don't think it's entire separation or throwing Bunyan in prison. I would advocate a middle road whereby you can, as I said, legitimately, you could separate church and state, but the state itself would need to recognise, through certain forms of legislation, the commitments and the worldviews and the practices of religious groups, rather than simply turning a blind eye to them.
Also, just to clarify my point, which I think you were perhaps commenting on, I was just emphasising human nature, as in it's literally impossible to prevent the interaction of religion with state, or any worldview, whether it's materialist or spiritual, because people will always repackage their demands in a form of, let's say, in a secular package. But they'll still be the same demands, motivated by the same motivation. As for the issue of, am I bringing a new definition of state, so establishment of church and state, whatever, well, we're not talking about the establishment or separation of the church and state, we're talking about religion and state. And there's been many academics that discuss this matter, like Charles Taylor's a very famous one, who discusses this and the different kind of modern plurality that we have to encounter. So it's been well known academically for many years.
Okay.
a woman in a white top.
Hello, I'm Yomsa Bokini. I'm a doctor and charter council member. I have a question for the nurse side. I don't believe anyone's actually addressed Zeynep, her point about what happens when there's a contradiction. And I think, Abdullah, you've just sort of mentioned it as if it's, I think you said demands. You said each side has a demand or whatever. What happens when these demands are in contradiction with the laws of the land? Thank you.
Okay. Well, basically, the laws of the land allow you to have any particular religious expression you wish, as long as it doesn't go into the realm of coercion, violence, and advocacy of violence. So that's a universal law and principle that generally people agree to. So in that sense, people want to express their religion in any particular way voluntarily. We have, for example, in the UK, Beit Din courts for Jewish arbitration in divorce and marriage, for example. Now, there have been some critics of Jewish laws and, of course, Islamic laws, saying these laws are not what we would, let's say, agree to, or we see eye to eye with these particular laws. But the fact that these are voluntary organizations and voluntary arbitration courts that no one is compelled to, not really courts, councils, that are no one's compelled to accept this, and an arbitration can come in any form as long as it's voluntarily agreed to. There's no conflict. But what you do find with certain conflict is, for example, in France, where the French government believed in the spirit of freeing the people, that it should ban public prayer as being ostentatious. So you can't pray in public. You can't have hijab in school. So if you're a woman and you want to choose just to cover your hair in for your own reasons in school, you're not allowed to do that in French school. And the niqab is prohibited in public. So if you're a woman and you're caught on the streets of France with a niqab, the police will arrest you and you will be fined. And if you don't pay that fine, of course, it might escalate to even imprisonment. So these are the issues that you face in France, and these are the kind of issues that we have to draw attention to as being an impingement of religious rights, which I think people would commonly agree to are not unreasonable for a woman to desire to want to cover her face with a niqab or want to wear hijab. If you believe that they should have these rights, then what argument could you advance to say that these people must be prevented from doing so?
Do you want to, does that address your point? Do you want to respond?
Yeah, it's not really the point, but I just want to add that personally I care much more about the women, the hundreds of millions of women who are obliged to wear the niqab in many parts of the world. This is actually also something we should mention. And in France, actually, the niqab was banned because it's forbidden to hide its face in the public place. So if you wear a helmet, or if you put a plastic bag on your head and you walk with it in the street, you will just be arrested also.
I'm going to intervene because we have limited time. Can I speak a show of hands and get a sense of how many questions are out there? Okay, that's fine. So I'll move to the next question and then you can add your point as you want. So there's a gentleman at the back and then I'll come to the front.
So the question that I have, I'm Manoj Graydon, I'm from the London School of Economics. The primary question that I have is for the no side. We've heard, this is just to clarify a little bit. So we've heard both sides are arguing against the presence of a theocracy. That wouldn't necessarily be fair based on the previous discussion. But I'm wondering if you could articulate a little bit more about what the complete separation would be. It's been kind of vague references to that, so I'm wondering if you could elucidate some points about how we
can
articulate that in a modern state.
Okay, and I think I will take the last two questions at the front. So there's two on the front row, a gentleman in a blue jacket and a gentleman in a check jacket, in either order. And if you remember to say you are, and if you can keep the questions relatively short, it would be very grateful.
I think religion cannot be separated from the state completely, because it is important that freedom believe is allowed, but as such, as it is in this country. I've lived here more than 60 years. I have never found any problem of any kind. And I'm Muslim, I'm practicing Muslim. I have no problem of any kind, and also I've been with Liberal Democrats for 45 years. So I find no difficulty as such. If you separate religion completely from the state, you will be allowing the extremism of atheism. Literally, that's what will happen.
Do you have a question that you want to... Also,
it is very wrong to say that covering the face is part of the Islamic culture. It is not. When you go for Hajj, in the Kaaba itself, people are not allowed to cover their face, and ladies and gents, both stand together. So that is the thing people do. Also, freedom cannot last if it is not used with respect for others and also with responsibility.
Thank you for that useful comment. And I'm going to take the last if you can manage to take them, we'll take the last two.
Emmanuel de Cat is my name. A quick comment. I think the actual wording of what the debate is about makes for huge differences of interpretation. And I would suggest that Chatham House next time choose a wording which everybody on the panel can agree on. That's my comment. A quick question to Abdullah. What you said seems to be perfectly straightforward for Britain, but how do you relate what you said to the many Islamic states around the world which have very different views about this?
And can we pass to the woman in the red top, please?
Shall I ask my question?
Yeah, please.
This is directed to Mr. Copson. Hello, my name is Annabel Gullist. I'm a graduate student at the LSE as well. And I had a look at your website earlier today, and in the video you explain that China is not truly a secular state per se because it is entangled in ideology, in the Marxist ideology, and that you define secularism as having the state separated from ideology or doctrine. But then, are Western states actually separated from doctrine? And isn't economic liberalism the Western ideology?
Okay, so I think we're coming to the end, so I'm going to ask you to respond to those questions and also make final remarks at the same time, if that's okay. I'm going to say some words so you can collect your thoughts while I do that, but I think it's interesting that Rawls has come up a few times, and Rawls is someone who doesn't use the term secularism in his work, so he provides useful frameworks, but actually doesn't like that. So we've raised issues with the language of separation, but he would possibly raise issues with religion as doing a lot of the work that it does in our discussion today. So for Rawls, comprehensive doctrines matter, and so on. Another important publication this year, alongside Andrew's, is a book by Cecile Laborde called Liberalism's Religion, which I highly recommend. And she argues that a lot of what we're talking about today isn't best described in terms of religion, and I think we might add to that focusing on religion might foster tensions that we wouldn't need to have. So, for example, she would say you can't offer a religious reason for a law because for the reason that laws need to be justified, they need to be accessible to all members of the population. But this moral would hold for other non-religious analogues. So it would include personal experience, for example. So I can't say this is going to be the law because in my experience this is the case. So there are always a set of analogues. So I wonder about the work that religion does in this question as well, and how well that serves our purpose, and whether it may do more harm than good. That's a comment you may or may not want to respond to. Respond to what you will, relatively briefly. Andrew.
Well, I say something perhaps quickly. I'll answer that specific question that was directed at me. But I'll say something very quickly about this idea of separation, because it is slightly surprising to me that it should be something that is open to different understandings, because there is, as the gentleman from the floor pointed out, a pretty conventional, clear, well-established and almost omnipresent in the field definition of separation of religion and state, which is that religious institutions are separate from state institutions and vice versa. They are not coterminous. They are different, and there is no domination of one by the other. Now, you may have an argument about whether it is separation that can best guarantee freedom and equality, but nonetheless, I think and that's the argument that would be interesting to have, but nonetheless, I think the concept of separation is a pretty clear and long-established one, I think, and that's my definition of it. My belief is that separation is the best way to guarantee freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, and equal treatment of different religious and non-religious people within a society. And I think that when you merge religious and state institutions, as they are merged in this country or in many other countries around the world, then you make society less free and less equal than it might otherwise be. And it is great that many people of non-Anglican beliefs have never had their lives impinged upon by, for example, establishment in this country. But if you were a non-religious parent and your local state-funded, 100% state-funded school that your taxes paid for was a Catholic one, you couldn't get your child in because you weren't a Catholic, because the state allows that sort of discrimination with public money, your experience would be different. And there are many other people less privileged than you who have had a very negative experience, even in this country where establishment is soft and the merging of religious and state institutions not as hard as it is in some of the Islamic states that we've been hearing about. The specific question has two parts. You're referring to the video on the OUP website about the publication of the book, and that's a reference to a particular chapter in my book where I talk about the extent to which Albania, Cuba, the Soviet Union, China could or should be called secular states. I say they shouldn't be called secular states because they established a particular type of atheism, and Marxist-Leninist states did, and that really is just the flip side of the coin to theocracy. It prohibits freedom of so on and so forth. As to your question about whether or not it is the case that surely Western democracies establish a sort of economic liberalism, well, that may well be the case. And I think that speaks to one of the things that Lewis just said about the extent to which Rawls should be held to be talking about comprehensive doctrines and worldviews rather than just religions. And that is a question for another debate, but a very good one.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Nick?
Right, so in the minute and a half that I have, with regard to the point about choosing the terms of the debate, it's a very good point, but I've never been involved in a debate that doesn't in some way come down to semantic questions of what words actually mean. I think this is an unavoidable problem. Picking up the question of what would complete separation look like and whether separation is a clearly defined thing, I come back to the point, I don't think it is. We know what complete disentanglement is, we know what complete involvement is, but would separation involve, say, the church funding church or faith schools? Would it allow for religious exemptions? Would it allow for conscience clauses? Would it allow the state to fund ostensibly religious programmes that were engaged in the common good? Now, there are different views on that. My view is that the church, that the state, in order to recognise and respect the views of its religious citizens, needs to be sensitive to those objections or those conscience clauses, needs to be sensitive to the goods that those local faith groups are trying to deliver in their communities, and needs to be prepared to get involved with them, whether that's legislating for exemptions or deploying public money. And that, to me, is not complete separation. That is the state constructively getting involved with what faith groups do. One final point that I didn't get a chance to respond to the earlier question, which picked up Zinner's point. I think this is absolutely critical. What do you do when the two are in tension? This is the issue. What do you do if religious groups and their ethic and their ways of running themselves are in tension with the state? I think a few things need to be said there. We live under the same rule of law. There should be no exceptions for that. And that is a non-negotiable point. But the ethic of the state, if you like, is not monolithic, it's not static, and it's not absolutely right. And so the rule of law, the shared rule of law imposed by the state under which we live and to which we are our allegiance, is nonetheless open to negotiation and questioning. We should obey it, but it doesn't mean that it can never move and can never be changed. And we know from history that states get things wrong, and it's very often people on the margins, people who are excluded from society, sometimes faith groups, sometimes not, that have questioned that ethic of the state and got the state to change. So we live under the same rule of law, but let's not imagine that is static, monolithic, and always correct.
Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, just to conclude briefly, for me, freedom of association is a pillar of any democracy. And of course, in the frame of freedom of association, religious groups does have the right to gather, to organize themselves, to campaign, just as any other sports, cultural, arts group, whatever. But the state must be neutral. To guarantee also this democratic frame, the state mustn't have no religion, no color, and it must embrace all its citizens in the same level. Those who have a personal spirituality, of course, their right to have that spirituality must be guaranteed, but they can keep it at home and they can share the public space with the others, having their spirituality but not imposing it to the others. It seems very simple and it seems to be the best way to live together.
Okay, it's quite a few points in the Q&A. Okay. As I said, complete separation is the state not funding faith schools, not giving charity exemptions for religious charities or humanist charities or any of the like. The state not recognizing Christmas or public holidays which be connected to religion. That's what complete separation looks like between religion and state. The state does not endorse any particular religion. Now, my kind of position today has really been one of consistency. If we're going to advance the idea of equality, and we're going to advance the idea that people should be treated equally and so on, and should have certain rights, and that the state should represent them, there is no argument you could argue to say that the state should separate itself from religion as long as it's treating every religion and none fairly and equally, which many states do. I think just to finish off, there was discussions of the niqab and the Ottoman, the Islamic system and so on and so forth. All I will say is that I come from a religious tradition that's had 1,300 years of religious tolerance. I would even say more than you could see in the West, because under Islamic systems, each religion or religious community had autonomous courts, fully blown courts, autonomous regions, zones. Even, for example, the Armenians, they had their own police force, for example, and they were left alone in a spirit of non-interference, which I think even the West hasn't been able to achieve with its minorities. What I will say is that the state, no state is really neutral. I mean, the French kind of banned the niqab and the hijab and so on, with discussions particularly about Muslims. You can't say, if I make a law saying that everyone must eat pork, and then obviously Jews and Muslims complain, say, no, we weren't targeting you particularly. We were just making a general law for everybody, right? That's what we call indirect discrimination, and it's also an issue. So they had their rights taken away in the name of a national culture, and this is the problem. States are not neutral. So I think that the best way to protect people's rights, for a state to recognize that there are plurality of religious beliefs which are based on conviction, to treat everyone equally and fairly, and the limit should be not to anyone to commit violence or to impose their belief by coercion, but rather to have each of their beliefs practiced as long as it's voluntarily. I think that's the most consistent approach for the Western context.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you to all of the panellists again. We'll join in a round of applause for them and for all of you who participated shortly. We get the chance to vote again. We'll see how that goes. I think in defence of the question, it is a good question because it's one we inherit from, as we've heard, centuries actually, two centuries at least, of talking about the relationship between religion and the state. And when I joined the political science department at UCL a few years ago and we set up the Religion and Political Theory Centre, I was sort of engaging with and surprised to learn, as I've been surprised to learn in sociology when I moved into that area, how little engagement there'd been with religion. And so there are a lot of questions. We inherit these relatively blunt tools, which we're really realising are blunt, and that there is a lot of nuance there. So thank you to the panel for, I think, drawing out, and to the questioners for drawing out some of the conversations we need to have. So I think maybe we might think about the extent of how separate do you think they should be? I think maybe we might say very separate or less separate, rather than thinking about these hard positions, but I think we do have a sense of difference here. So we'll try. Let's try the voting things. So
everyone won.
Great. Yeah, we don't have. We're supposed to see who's had the most movement.
And I think, strictly speaking, it's the nose.
The infinity fold.
That's mathematically true.
Well, actually, the not shores have had a major change. More of you have decided, so we could be very diplomatic and say we give it to the not shores. I think we're all winners in terms of learning about this question. And so thank you to you all. Please leave these devices. Chatham House say they would really like to keep them. And thanks. Let's enjoy thanking the panel, and thanks to you.